good afternoon, or for some of you, good morning or good evening. I'd like to, I'm Larry Diamond, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and chair of our project on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. And I'd like to welcome you to the second session of this six-part conference. Today we have a real treat. We're going to look at one of the, I'd say, most neglected but important dimensions of China's rise and projection of sharp power in the Indo-Pacific region, and that is the dimension of natural resources and sustainable development. Before I introduce our extremely distinguished moderator for today, I once again want to thank the staff of the Hoover Institution for their help with this project, including Betsy Phillips, Janet Smith, and Mike Wong. And I want to thank the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in San Francisco for their support of this project. Min-Shin Pei is a longtime friend of the Hoover Institution. He was a national fellow here many years ago. He's been a professor at Princeton, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and for many years now, professor of political science at Claremont McKenna College. Dr. Pei is one of the leading experts in the world on politics, governance, and development, and international presence of the People's Republic of China and U.S. China and U.S. Asia relations. He's the author of three extremely influential books from Harvard University Press, From Reform to Revolution, The Demise of Communism in China and the Soviet Union, China's Trap Transition, The Limits of Developmental Autocracy, and most recently, China's Crony Capitalism, The Dynamics of Regime Decay. And I'm extremely pleased to announce that he will be this year's Seymour Martin Lipset Lecturer later this fall for the National Endowment for Democracy. Min-Shin, thank you so much for agreeing to chair our panel, moderate this discussion, share a bit of your wisdom, and the floor is now yours.
Thank you very much, Larry. It's a real honor to chair this very, very distinguished panel. We have, as Larry said, a real treat. Natural resource management is an overlooked issue when we think about the Indo-Pacific. So today, we will have three experts who will share with us their knowledge and analysis of the issue of fishery management, the natural resource dispute in the South China Sea, and also logging and tuna management in official management in the South Pacific. Leading off will be Professor Wang Guangxiong, if I'm correct, of Taiwan. A graduate of the Graduate Institute of Political Science at the National Taiwan Normal University. I'm sorry, this is. And then he will be followed by Dr. Emily Meiding, who is an assistant professor of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Our last speaker on the panel is Dr. Transform Okoro, who is the Solomon Islands Ambassador to the United Nations and a visiting professor at the Solomon Islands National University. The discussant for the panel is my good friend, Dr. Elizabeth Economy, who is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and also a senior fellow for China Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. So the floor is yours, Professor Wang.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for introducing me, Professor Pei. And I also would like to take this opportunity to express my sincere gratitude to the organizer, Hoover Institute, especially Professor Larry Diamond and Glenn for including me in this event. The topic of my presentation today is the intensifying competition over fisheries. So first of all, I would like to introduce the background, current situation, and the possible solution to the fishery competitions, as well as the disputes in the South China Sea region. So please turn to the next slide, please. The outlines of my presentation today will be in the following several points. The first one is the fishery resources in the South China Sea, and then that will be the causes to jeopardize fishery resources management in the South China Sea, and then the incentives for fishery cooperation and management. I would like to divide it into two parts, that is the legal framework and economic stimulation. And then I would make a conclusion. So next one, please. In order to have a better understanding about the different areas for the fishery catch data, the United Nations Convention, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization established 27 major fishing areas. And the South China Sea region is within the area 71, which is under the title of Western Central Pacific. Let's look at the more details about the catch data of the area 71. Next, please. This is the fishery resources in the South China Sea. As we can see, in terms of the global production of marine capture fisheries, it reaches about 79 million tons in 2016. And especially for the area 71, the Western Central Pacific, where the South China Sea locates, contributes 12.7 million tons, which is about 17% of global marine production. Or we can say it more specifically, it will be around 12% of the global fish catch comes from the South China Sea in 2015, where also hosts more than half of the world's fishing vessels. In other words, the South China Sea is one of the most important and abundant commercial fishing grounds in the world. It is also categorized as one of the large marine ecosystems. Although it covers only 3.1 million square kilometers, but it represents 8.6% of the world's surface. It harbors about 4,000 fish species, which is about 22% of the fish species reported from the world oceans. And more specifically, that we can understand that the South China Sea contains 7% of the world's coral reefs. So many highly migratory species and straddling stocks could be found in this region. So next page, please. However, there are deep concerns regarding the conditions of the resources, especially the fishery resources, with most stock being either fully exploited or over-exploited. And even I can say that many of them also even depleted, particularly in the western part of the South China Sea. And also other researches show that nearly 80% of coral reefs in the South China Sea were at risk. Two-thirds of the major fish species and several of the region's most important fishing areas are fully or even over-exploited by the destructive measures employed. Next page, please. The picture show on this page, we can recognize that the lady is the her name is Nina Hachigian. She served as the second United States ambassador to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, that is ASEAN, from the year 2014 to 2017. She did several thorough studies on the fishery issues in the Southeast Asia. And here is what she mentioned about the conditions in the South China Sea. I quote her words, illegal, unreported, and regulated fishing in the area is widespread. Common methods such as dynamite fishing, cyanide poisoning, and bottom trawling have wreaked havoc in regional ecosystems and threatened the future of the regional fishing market. About 40% of the South China Sea fish stocks have already disappeared, and 70% of the South China Sea coral reefs are rated to be in fair or poor condition. So her words clearly express the poor conditions of the South China Sea, even though we are still cracking high catches up. Next page, please. I categorize the reason for jeopardizing fishery resources management in the South China Sea into two parts. One is the overcapacity situation from fishing industry as well as the huge demands for the market. The other is a struggle for fishing grounds as well as the fighting for sovereignty or control over maritime features and adjacent maritime areas. So let's take a look at the first one. In the year 2014, ASEAN countries contribute a third of the global seafood exports. Take China, for example. China's export totally nearly $21 billion US dollars, accounting for 12.5% of the total global exports in 2014. And for example, another two countries that will be Thailand and Indonesia, they also occupies the quite great percentage of the world exportation. So it is understandable that fisheries have been the leading industry of the major sources of animal protein, employment, livelihood, and foreign exchange, which have a great impact on the livelihood of those littoral states, nationals of the South China Sea. Then it won't be difficult to understand that fishing industry provide a source of food, and it is a major component of the economy and also a source of the employment. So this page also shows the common practice. Oh, sorry. So next page, please. Okay. Yeah. This one. Right. The second part of this this item that we can understand, it is a common practice for states bordering the South China Sea to fight for sovereignty over maritime features, as well as sovereign rights over resources. Fish is one of the most valuable living resources in this region. We can understand that China has exercised a fishing ban in the South China Sea since 1999, as we can notice from the left-hand side of the picture. The fishing ban period is from May to August every year, and the area covers the waters north to 12 degrees north latitude in the South China Sea. However, as we can see from the map on the left, the area would be definitely overlap with the exclusive economic zone of Vietnam and the Philippines. Therefore, the number of fishery disputes would be rising every year when China announced its annual fishing ban. For example, in this past April, a Vietnamese fishing vessel with 8 fishermen on board was fishing near the Paracel Islands, and it was rammed and sunk by a Chinese maritime police vessel. Besides, the Department of the Foreign Affairs in Manila expressed a deep concern over the reported sinking of the Vietnamese fishing boat off the Paracel Islands. However, China's response was to demand for an investigation with its own statement and also accusing the Vietnamese boat of illegally entering Chinese water and conducting dangerous actions. In this page, I would like to say that cooperation and management would be the best way to solve the fishery disputes in the South China Sea. However, it also might be a right way to find out in the incentive behind them. Therefore, I'm going to introduce the background for cooperation and management on fishery resources. Next page, please. Right. First one is the legal framework for building up cooperation. And we all know that there is a convention called 1982 UNCLOS. And I like to say that UNCLOS paves a way for the future cooperation. According to Article 122, South China Sea is a semi-enclosed sea, and in accordance with the next Article 123, it provides a legal basis for promoting cooperation and coordination in fishery resources management in the areas for the countries surrounding the South China Sea. Therefore, we can specifically look at into the article that it says that states bordering an enclosed or semi-enclosed sea should cooperate with each other to coordinate their management, conservation, exploration, and exploitation of the living resources of the sea. So I would recognize this as the legal basis for fishing, for fisheries cooperation. Next page, please. And the second one, I think it is very important to realize the motivation behind IUU, I mean the illegal fishing activities. I found out there is a recent development which is very effective. That is the EU's anti-IUU regulation. The EU pays great attention on the environment and the social economic impacts generated from the IUU fishing. And under the consideration that the IUU fishing might endanger the fundamental basis of EU common fisheries policy, as well as impair EU's effort on better marine management, the European Union Council, adopted the EU IUU regulation in 2008, and this regulation entered into force in 2010. And about this so-called the EU IUU regulation, a CARD process is applied in this regulation. It begins with the initiation of dialogue by the European Commission with a country that they thought that country is not good or doesn't hold good record for fishery. And depending on the result by the country to undertake necessary reforms, the Commission may decide to issue an official warning to the country. That is the first stage. That, as we can see from the slide, that is the yellow card from the upper left. And then the commission may decide to issue an official warning to the country. That is the yellow card I mentioned before, which will be followed by formal identification as a non-cooperating country. Then that will become the red card. Or if they are doing very well, I mean, for those countries they are doing well, very well, then the yellow card will be lifted, and then they will be give the green card, just like the football game. And actually, I can say that this kind of system had already generated a very good result. For the first, the if they think that that country doesn't do very well on the management or on the conservation measures, then that country will be even worse than the red card. They will be give the black card, and then the result will be a ban on the importing seafood products into the EU market. And that might be the most serious measures. And however, it will be the most efficient measures to combat IUU fishing, because this concerns the huge economic loss for that country. And next page, please. So from this page that we can understand that for the countries surrounding the South China Sea, including Taiwan, Thailand, Vietnam, and the Philippines, we all have this kind of treatment. But luckily, I shouldn't say luckily, I should say that we pay in a lot of efforts to change or to promote our management and conservation measures, so that, for example, Taiwan, Philippines, and Thailand, we are lifting the yellow card, and therefore we could have a normal and a normal trade relationships about the fishery products with the European Union. However, Vietnam is still working on promoting their management measures. And we can see on the right-hand side, that is the Cambodia. And obviously Cambodia, they didn't pass that kind of examination, and it is suffering the ban on the seafood products export into the European Union. Next page, please. But it is time for wrapping up my presentation and come to the conclusion. I think that is the last page for my presentation. And fish and fish products are vital aspects of the of the world's diet, economy, and even the concerns with biodiversity. Under the situation of efficient management, overwhelming evidence shows that these crucial uses of the marine world resources are in danger. So consequently, the depletion of fishery resources is not only a crisis for food, but also a crisis for environment. And the South China Sea, I believe, is facing such a situation. And two elements could be identified as the causes to encourage illegal fishing activities. One is the overcapacity situation from the fishing industry, and as well as the huge demands from the market. And the other is the struggle for fishing grounds, as well as the fighting for sovereignty or control over maritime features and adjacent maritime areas. But basically, the economic stimulation might be the main reason. Therefore, in this regard, in order to achieve effective progress in combating and deterring the IUU, the incentive of illegal fishing should be understood, and then that kind of illegal activities could be eliminated. I think the EU IUU regulation might be one of the successful approaches through trade measures. EU sanctions have prevented illegally captured fish products from entering into EU market. This will not only block the channel for illegal catches trade, but also raise awareness for the relevant countries to improve their domestic laws and policies. Perhaps this is the approach for combating IUU fishing, and it deserves further consideration for future cooperation. And lastly, I would like to say that ocean governance shall be the approach and attitude in managing and conserving fishery resources. More specifically, this could be applied to the region of the South China Sea. And we also can apply the UNCLOS Article 123. I think that article could be served as the basic framework, legal framework for building up mutual confidence and pave the way to improve, to evolve the economic consideration into policy decisions so that to reduce the illegal fishing activities could be implemented in this region, I mean the South China Sea. Okay, so next page, please. And this will be my presentation about the intensifying fishery resources in the South China Sea area. And thank you very much for your listening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Huang. This is a very brief but very illuminating presentation of a very serious problem. Our next panelist is Professor Maya Ding. So the floor is yours.
First, thank you all for being here, especially those of you that aren't on Pacific Standard Time. I don't know what time it is for you, but I imagine it's less convenient. I'm really excited to have the opportunity to talk today about oil and gas development in the South China Sea. It has been an interesting 18 to 24 months in the South China Sea when it comes to oil and gas. This is a topic that people generally, they sort of identify a lot as a cause of contention in the region, but analyses are often pretty superficial. Meanwhile, we have had a lot of confrontations recently. China has been interfering with Malaysia and Vietnam's oil and gas exploration. It's also been conducting its own seismic surveys in waters that are claimed by multiple countries. The image on the left is the Chinese seismic survey ship that's been doing these surveys. The image on the right is the path that this ship took for one of its surveys. So when I was writing my paper for the conference, the primary motivation that I had was to answer the question, how did we get here? What has oil and gas development looked like in the South China Sea, and what brought us to this point? So most of my talk today will be basically a historical narrative, tracing oil and gas development in the South China Sea from the late 1950s until today. At the end of the talk, though, I'll say a little bit about what does this mean? What does this mean for oil and gas competition in the region? And what can we extrapolate about how oil and gas figure into countries' motives in the dispute? I just got a notice from Zoom saying my connection is unstable, so I hope that's not affecting my talk. Just, you know, hope for the best. Should also warn you up front, I'm not going to be saying much about Taiwan because it has not been particularly involved in oil and gas development in the region. And also geographically, I'm really going to be focused on the South China Sea itself, not looking at the Gulf of Tonkin or the Gulf of Thailand. So I think that it's really helpful to have visuals when we're talking about this historical narrative. So most of my slides will be this map with various things added to it. Just to walk you through what I'm showing here, map of the South China Sea, including China's nine-dash-line claim. The events that take place are color-coded. I've divided oil and gas development in the South China Sea into six stages. So I'll talk about the stage before oil and gas, and then I'll talk about each stage in turn. There's also coding islands slash features. I'll use the terms interchangeably, even though the Permanent Court of Arbitration has ruled there are no islands in much of the South China Sea. So those are circles. Triangles are events that have to do specifically with the oil and gas industry. So drill rigs, seismic survey ships, et cetera. And shaded areas are areas that countries have granted licenses for oil or gas exploration. So my discussion of the dispute starts in 1946. World War II is over. The Japanese have withdrawn from the features that they occupied during the war. And the first real activity we see in the dispute is in 1946. The Republic of China claims one half of the Paracel Islands, the Amphitrite group. France claims the other half, also in 1946. And the Republic of China also occupies one of the Spratly features, Itu Abu. Soon afterwards, at some point in 1950, Republic of China leaves the Paracels after losing the Civil War. In 1950 to 1951, most countries in the region assert claims to the Paracel and Spratly Islands. In 1955, China starts occupying the set of islands formerly occupied by Taiwan. But then the next real significant event in this dispute is actually not initiated by a state. It's by a private citizen, Thomas Cloma of the Philippines, who decides in 1956 that he wants to claim most of this area west of Palawan. Other countries, none too happy about this, but nothing really happens. Importantly, at this point, say 1946 to 1956, no one's thinking about oil and gas. The first offshore oil rig is not drilled anywhere worldwide until 1947. That's the date of the first rig out of sight of land in the Gulf of Mexico. By 1956, it's still only the US that's doing offshore oil exploration. The areas in the South China Sea, not super promising. So oil and gas are not an initial motive for the dispute. However, then we get to stage one. In stage one of oil and gas development, we see established oil producing countries going offshore. So first, Malaysia, which has already got an active oil industry, starts drilling offshore oil wells off of Sabah. Hits their first strike in 1963, later major strikes in 1972 to 73. In addition, Indonesia issues awards concessions for people to explore for oil in this area around the Natuna Islands. Pretty straightforward. Next stage, other states start to get in on the game. We see the first major seismic survey of large portions of the South China Sea in 1969. That's actually sponsored by a United Nations agency. It looks fairly promising. So after that, first, the Philippines initiates oil and gas exploration, award concessions in 1970, start drilling in this area immediately off of Palawan in 1971, strike oil in 1976. They also issue concessions for this area, which is Reed Bank. They start exploring for oil in 1975. They make a minor discovery. And this one, other countries are pretty unhappy about. At the same time, the Philippines starts occupying features in the Spratlys. So it joins Taiwan. Vietnam also decides, hey, we want a piece of that. So they issue oil concessions starting in 1973. They drill oil wells in 1974, both close to shore and further away. And by mid-1975, they have also found oil. In the meantime, they also start occupying more features in the Spratly Islands. This period also sees the first major confrontation in the dispute. When China takes over the other half of the Paracel Islands in 1974. After that, there's also a report that maybe the Chinese are drilling on one of the islands, but it's pretty sketchy. Stage three, things calm down in the Paracels, they calm down in the Spratlys, and instead, attention shifts to this area north of the Natuna Islands. The concessions that Vietnam has awarded overlap with the concessions that that Indonesia has awarded. In 1980, Indonesia starts trying to develop the area more. There's a minor military confrontation, not much happens. Mostly these two states just talk it out. So not a lot going on. Stage four, this is when China starts to enter the picture. Up until this point, China's actually been a latecomer to the Spratly Island dispute. But in 1983, the country starts conducting oceanographic surveys, both in this northern area and all the way south as far as James Shoal. They conduct their survey down there. This provokes Malaysia to start occupying Spratly features. In 1987, China does its first seismic survey. And in 1988, it occupies its first feature, Fiery Cross Reef. This also provokes then the next major military confrontation in the South China Sea dispute. This is over Johnson Reef between China and Vietnam in 1988. And in this confrontation, over 60 Vietnamese sailors are killed. China also decides that it's going to get into the act with oil exploration. So in 1992, it awards a concession known as the Wanon Bay 21 area to an American oil company. Vietnam, none too happy about this since it's in their claimed territory. They issue a concession to the same territory. They also establish agreements with other American oil companies to explore in this area. And from around 1994, we see a number of militarized clashes. These are pretty minor. They involve one country trying to lay siege to another country's oil rig, or one country cutting the cables on seismic survey ships. They never escalate, but there's definitely some sparring happening. During the same period, we also see some sparring between the Philippines and China involving oil. In 1995, the Philippines approves what's called the desktop survey. This means you're not sending seismic survey ships, you're not drilling, you're just looking at maps, basically. But it's for this large area of the Spratly Islands. Possibly in response, China then occupies Mischief Reef, which will become a major point of contention for the two countries. Finally, we also see some tensions between China and Indonesia during this point. In 1995, Indonesia again tries to develop this area north of the Natuna Islands. The Chinese claim the territory, and Indonesia stages its largest ever naval exercises. So things are definitely picking up at this point, 80s through the 90s. Then we actually get a brief period of calm and cooperation. There are a number of different agreements between national oil companies during this period in the early 2000s. But the most significant one is between the national oil companies of China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. in 2004, they agree that they're going to jointly do a joint seismic survey for this whole pink area. And they actually get through phase one, they get through phase two, they conduct their seismic surveys. But then the deal falls apart because people in the Philippines find out and they're not very happy about it. Which brings us to stage six, if you're not completely overwhelmed by this point. In stage six, we see another resurgence in Chinese activity. But at this point, China isn't so much trying to do its own oil and gas exploration as it is trying to obstruct other countries. So first in 2007, it actually pressures international oil companies to leave projects in Vietnam, both down near Wanan Bay 21 and also in the Central Coast. Then it interferes with seismic surveys and drilling operations basically all over the South China Sea. Many of these different, against the Philippines, against Malaysia, against Vietnam, there's a lot of interference. That's from 2011 to 2013. All of this culminates in an event you've almost certainly heard about, which is the confrontation over a drilling rig in 2014 between Vietnam and China. This is another serious military confrontation. Both countries send a lot of ships, one is sunk, and it provokes major protests in Vietnam. After that, we do get a couple years of calm, but then again, the Chinese government pressures the Spanish oil company, Repsol, to withdraw from a couple of projects. That's in 2017, 2018. And then in 2019, Chinese ships start interfering with the operations of Vietnamese. This is a project between the Russian national oil company, Rosneft, and Vietnam's national oil company. They also start interfering with a project that Malaysia's conducting. Lastly, we see intervention with projects that Malaysia is conducting out here, further towards the middle of the sea. In the meantime, in this 2019 period, China is also conducting its own seismic surveys. All of these squiggly black lines are survey areas. So that is a very quick trip through 60 years of oil and gas development, which brings us to the question, what does it all mean? So I have some conclusions that are based more on oil and gas and some that are specifically focused on China. So, one, oil and gas didn't start the dispute. These were not the dispute's original causes. The contest predates oil and gas interests. Second, oil and gas definitely became an additional point of contention. This is something that countries care about. This is something that they have taken actions to gain and protect access. However, oil and gas confrontations don't escalate. All of the sparring that we see around oil and gas resources involves pretty minor incidents. Again, cables being cut, oil rigs being chased out of contested territory. The 2014 rig incident is the most substantial, but again, it's non-fatal, and importantly, it doesn't escalate. Countries are very good at putting a lid on these kinds of confrontations. They don't seem to want to get into a larger conflict for oil and gas. So what does it mean in terms of China? Well, my sense, especially looking at the most recent period, is 2007 to now, is that claimant countries' interests with regard to oil and gas are diverging. Basically, everyone except China, so Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Vietnam, really wants to develop the region's oil resources. They want to explore, they want to develop, they want to produce, they want to exploit, they want to consume those resources at home and sell them internationally. In contrast, China seems less interested in actually accessing the region's oil for itself and more interested in denying it to these other countries. Another observation, as China's power has grown, so have its actions related to oil and gas. Consequently, I don't expect China to become less assertive. I think that we will continue to see the actions that we're seeing now. And China, again, I don't think it's doing this in order to try to, it's not prioritizing accessing the oil and gas. It's more interested in using those resources as a bargaining chip. The other countries want to develop them. Therefore, China can use that. It can use that to try to get the countries to agree to joint development of oil and gas, which A, gets these countries, gets China access to the region's oil and gas resources. But it also, if a country agrees to joint development, it legitimates China's claim. The 2016 ruling from the Permanent Court of Arbitration said, no dice, there are no legal grounds for this claim. But if a country says, yes, I'll do joint development with you, that sort of pushes the other way. So I think China will use the dispute as a bargaining chip for joint development to legitimate its claim, and also potentially to advance other interests. You want to develop those oil resources? What are you going to give me? So that is actually it for my talk. I seem to be a bit under time. So thank you very much. I am happy to answer questions or return with more detail later.
Okay. Well, thank you for staying under your time budget. And this is, again, a very illuminating analysis of the South China Sea dispute as far as oil and gas is concerned. Our next speaker is Ambassador and Dr. Transform Okwara. So Dr. Okwara, the floor is yours.
Yeah, good morning from Solomon Islands, everyone. I apologize, I don't actually have a PowerPoint presentation, but I have a paper that you may be able to read. I'd like to be able to share a little bit of my experience in resource management and my observations of the tensions that are obviously taking place or have taken place over the past 30 years and also continue to take place over two key strategic resources. Tuna, for which the Western and Central Pacific has the world's largest and healthiest stocks. And also tropical lumber or timber, which might not necessarily be of you know, economic interest to many of you, but my small country happens to be the largest exporter of tropical hardwoods to China, and we are ranked seventh globally in terms of exports of timber to the Chinese market, which is the largest market, as I understand it, in the world. Just to take a step back, as I look at the evolution of tuna, first let me talk about tuna, and then what I want to really show is to demonstrate that the effectiveness of the way in which you manage the resources and the way in which you respond and the economic benefits that flow from the resources flow as a result of the business models that are designed and developed, and also because of the political economy. And so, as you can probably see from my paper, I've just contrasted that regional cooperation and collective action actually yields better economic outcomes. And I'm more convinced that you know, maybe if we did not have the kind of international, what I describe as the three-tiered structured system for the management of our tuna resources, it would be very much subject to the, you know, the vagaries of national political impulses, and which we're seeing in our logging, in our forest resources, and which we also see in some of our nationally based resources like minerals. And also, there's a particular seafood that is a delicacy in Asia, which is bechdime, or sea cucumber. And that too is very, very politically charged, and quite sadly actually, because the resource owners are the ones who actually lose out a lot, both economically and also in terms of the ecosystem, the damage that's done to the ecosystem as a result of the extraction of those resources from their waters. So let me just turn to tuna. My very first foray into tuna was around 32 years ago, and I, as a young legal officer in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I participated in access negotiations with some very experienced Japanese negotiators. But what really struck me at the time was the unequal relationship that was quite obvious between negotiating with some of the world's superpowers. The Americans did not recognize our sovereign rights over tuna, and of course my country lost a fairly significant amount of revenue as a result of sanctions that they imposed when we arrested one of their fishing boats in the early 1980s. And so the whole process of tuna management was shrouded in controversy in terms of, on the one hand, Pacific Island countries were trying to assert their newly found sovereign rights that they were able to, acquire as a result of the UN process. But what is interesting is that for us in the Pacific Islands, the idea of the 200-mile exclusive economic zone is intertwined with the notion of self-determination, because the 1982 Lobsi Convention was negotiated around the time when many of our countries were getting independent. So we viewed the whole notion of the exclusive economic zone as an economic instrument that would help us develop our countries and would help us in terms of our economic revenues. But right from the outset, we had to struggle to assert our sovereignty, our sovereign rights. We had to struggle against the superpowers, United States. But eventually, I think we were able to come around, and with the United States, there was a multilateral agreement that was resolved, and I happened to be attend the occasion of the deposit by the United States government of the instrument of ratification. But that largely resolved an impasse and a political problem between the United States and the Pacific Island countries. But it did not really resolve a lot of the issues that we faced. And I think even today, even though I've expressed in my paper that we do have a good, at least we have a process and institutions in place that would help insulate ourselves from some of the political pressures that are seen in other resources, because on the one hand, you're still seeing efforts by some of these powerful fishing countries trying to take control over the fisheries. So the contestation that you see in the region is really about control over the fisheries, support for your nationals, and control as to who can actually get the economic benefits. So we're seeing also some of the pressures that that the European Union have been putting through. And I know our esteemed first speaker, Min-Jin Pei, you mentioned about the EU-IUU regulations, which is actually very good, because that helps to influence behavior as well. But I think there's been a disproportionate imbalance in the way in which it's been applied to some of the countries in the Pacific, like having Tuvalu, for example. which is a small island country of around 9,000 people, for whom tuna is an important instrument, have a yellow card imposed on them for no apparent reason at all, other than the fact that the European Union did not really support the Vessel Day scheme, and maybe there were some things that the Tuvalu ambassador had said in the United Nations that had upset the European Union. So they came down and then imposed a yellow card. So that actually cost the government of Tuvalu a fairly considerable amount of money in terms of the adjustments to meeting the EU demands. I think the bottom line, though, is that what I'm really trying to share in terms of the contestation is that while on the one hand, the Pacific Island countries and the countries of the Western Central Pacific, including Indonesia and Pacific, who are continuing to struggle against some of the measures that the powerful fishing countries are able to assert and use their market forces. So as primary producers, we're constantly contesting, on the one hand, the assertion of our rights, but at the same time, we don't have control over the market. And so the market is being controlled by the European Union. The sashimi market is controlled by Japan. And also the United States controls the canned tuna market. And so, you know, we're having to struggle all along against those kind of contestation with these countries. So we're seeing a lot of these things being played out. And then we can't also ignore the China factor as well in the tuna fisheries. In the last few years in particular, the growth of the Chinese longline fishery in the region has been phenomenal, to the extent that it has actually resulted in the economic dislocation of some of the domestic fleets, the domestic longline fleets, largely because they're not able to compete. Most of the Chinese government gives 35% subsidy on fuel to their vessels. And then if the fish is taken back to China and then reprocessed and then exported to the United States, they get a 0% duty, or in fact a 15% rebate. So in that kind of environment, it's almost impossible to compete with these new dynamics in the fishery. So that's more about the economics of the fishery and the struggles that the countries are having to put up with. And so there are these tensions that are going on in terms of above the what I characterize as above the water tensions, dealing with some of the relationships that we have with many of the world's superpowers. And then at the same time, we have these tensions in respect of ensuring that the resources underneath the water remain sustainable. And to that extent, we also struggle as well because, you know, we don't often share the same view of what is sustainable and sustainability. And so the whole idea of trying to get us to agree around what's known as harvest control rules and harvest strategies, these are predefined ways in which you look and manage the resources. It's often difficult. But having said all of that, as I pointed out in my paper, in terms of the tuna management, I think we've done very well globally in terms of the way in which the tuna is managed. We're the only region in the whole, I think, out of the major tuna region in the world, in which the stocks are relatively healthy. But that does not mean that we have to be complacent. There are imperfections, I think, in the systems, in that our relationships with you know, China and now with the contestation between China and the United States in the region, it's quite obvious that some of that is coming to the fore in terms of the way in which we manage our not just our relationships with these countries, the Asian countries and the United States and European Union, but also in the way in which the decisions are being made in the Tuna Commission. It's quite obvious that you know, some of those tensions are coming out to play. So that's on tuna. If I can just close off and just make a little bit of, I think our forestry is one of the saddest. It's a real sad story. It's actually disgraceful. I belong to families that have been victimized, and most of the logging companies that are operating both here in Solomon Islands and also Papua New Guinea, and we know that how important our forest cover is to you know, greenhouse gas emissions and supporting all of that. But it's really sad the way in which the political economy of logging companies, in which particularly, and I say so with a great amount of respect as well. I don't intend to. You know, to be demeaning in any way, but most of the logging companies, almost practically all of the logging companies associated with Malaysian logging companies and Malaysian Chinese companies who have actually, they've been able to have so much influence. It's an undue influence over the political system. And so when we look at resource management, I always think, from my experience in tuna, that the way in which you design the business model and the business around it's the instruments and the nature of the instruments that actually has an impact and influence on economic outcomes. But that's easier said than done. It's easier to be done in an environment in which you've got other people that are watching over you as well. So with tuna, you've got an accountability. You're accountable, not just to your own government, but you're accountable to the region, and you're accountable to your international obligations and your partners. So while on the one hand, I did say that, you know, working with US and the European Union have made things a bit more complex, but I think it has also ensured that there's a higher standard of accountability. But in contrast, when you look at the way in which our forestry resources, and I went to Shanghai and I saw all the logs that come from Solomon Islands, it really saddened me to see how we have allowed ourselves to be exploited in the way that we have. And people have become, instead of being empowered by their resources or enfranchised, we have allowed ourselves to be disenfranchised. Now, these are just my own personal views and observations that I've made, largely because of my own personal experience as well in terms of logging. And these are certainly views that I have expressed to our governments and also to our politicians. So on that basis, I would like to, you know, thank you all, and also at the same time perhaps make a bit of an appeal that there's a huge opportunity for us to be looking at not just at the tensions that occur, but I think the looking at some of the arrangements that can be developed in order to support resource owners. So thank you very much. And thank you very much again for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Dr. Akwara. This is indeed a very, very powerful account. And your story, I hope our audience will convey to their friends and their colleagues. Before I invite Dr. Economy to deliver her comments, I would like to welcome the audience to submit their questions by using the button Q&A, which is located on the lower right of your screen. And I will try to get them addressed by the panelists after Dr. Economy's comments. So Liz, the floor is yours.
Great, thanks so much, Minxin. And let me just thank Larry Diamond and Glenn Tiffert for inviting me to participate as a discussant for this panel. It really was a pleasure to read these papers, and I would commend them to all the participants on the line. Since I did have the opportunity to read all of them, I thought I might use my time just to share some of the broader themes and questions that occurred to me as I read through the papers and considered them as a collection. The first point is that whether we're talking about the unsustainable or illegal logging or illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing that Ambassador and Dr. Acora detailed so finely in his paper, or the conflicts over fishery resource management that Dr. Wong illuminated, or the assertive and aggressive behavior around the oil and gas exploration in the South China Sea that Dr. Meierding so ably described, many actors are involved. This is not just a story about China, but China really is a central actor. And moreover, China's role in the unsustainable and illegal exploitation of natural resources has been a defining element of its economic development path for decades, at least dating back to its 1999 Go Out strategy under Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji, which essentially encouraged Chinese entities to go abroad to extract and exploit resources to fuel China's continued economic growth. And this also includes the ethnically Chinese companies in Southeast Asia of the type that Dr. Acora mentions in his discussion of the timber trade. So the behavior that I think is described in these papers has in many respects become part of the country's economic DNA. And I think that makes it particularly difficult to change. I also think it's worth considering how China's longstanding challenge with official corruption, which Minxin has written extensively about in primarily a domestic context, may affect its role in these transnational resource activities, and whether perhaps the anti-corruption campaign has had any impact, whether we've seen any improvement in this regard. I tend to think not, but I'd be interested if any of the authors had any thoughts. The second point is simply the added complexity in resolving resource disputes in the South China Sea that's introduced by Chinese sovereignty claims. And Dr. Meierding, I think, makes the important point that China's assertive behavior is driven not as much by its desire for oil and gas, but rather as a means of asserting its regional authority. So even when China is willing to undertake joint development of resources, it necessitates other countries recognizing the legitimacy of China's nine-dash line. I think there's a somewhat analogous situation in the fisheries case in that the Chinese government deploys fishing boats as part of a broader maritime strategy related to sovereignty in the South China Sea, in which, in some cases, fishing is actually a secondary objective. So one question that occurs to me is, you know, the extent to which it makes sense to locate these issues in the context of national security or economic development. And what policy implications does it have in terms of assigning responsibility and identifying the appropriate policy responses? A third point is that while these papers naturally focus on resource exploitation in the Asia Pacific, these are global problems. And here too, China emerges as one of, if not the most important player. The same sort of disregard for international law, regimes, informal norms that China often displays in the cases detailed in these papers is also present in China's resource engagement in Africa and Latin America. There have been a number of reports of Chinese fishing boats swarming off the coast of Ecuador and Peru or Africa. There is even concern emerging about Chinese overexploitation of krill in Antarctica. And China has also driven the illegal timber trade in Ghana, Gabon, and Mozambique. So in addition, overfishing and unsustainable or illegal logging are just two global environmental concerns in which China is the world's dominant player. It is, of course, the world's largest contributor to global climate change, to ocean pollution, and to trade in endangered species. To me, this suggests that its rhetoric notwithstanding, China has yet to truly integrate the concept of sustainability into its overall economic development path. This then leads to my fourth and somewhat more hopeful point, and that is, how can resource-rich but often smaller and in some cases still developing economies change this pattern of Chinese behavior? And I think both Dr. Wang and Dr. Okora have offered good examples of how regimes can come into being and be enforced. To their examples, I would add the Port State Measures Agreement, which bars ships with illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing from using ports. You know, here's a case where China operates 14 of the 15 busiest ports through which this IUU fish are landed. But China is not yet party to the agreement. So then the question becomes, how do you get China to sign on to things? And it reminded me of another approach that small states can take. If you look back to China's decision to sign on to the 2014, its decision to say that it would have its climate change, its greenhouse gas emissions peak in 2030. Part of this was, of course, President Obama reaching across to President Xi Jinping, but the backstory there was really how the small island nations brought pressure to bear on China to do the right thing. And so a question arises, is there the possibility of, you know, smaller states, economically developing states, you know, developing coalitions and publicly, you know, raising these issues with China? In fact, perhaps shaming China into doing the right thing. I think China is far less comfortable in many respects pushing back when called out by countries that it often purports to represent, and particularly given Xi Jinping's ambition at this point to be seen as a global leader, as a leader on climate change and other environmental issues, I think such pressure might in fact have an important impact. That brings me to my fifth point around the role of outside actors. So given the globalized nature of the challenges that we're discussing, I guess I wonder what role the authors, and in particular Dr. Wang and Ambassador Okora, might see for international non-governmental organizations, such as the Nature Conservancy, Global Witness, or even international government organizations, governmental organizations such as the International Tropical Timber Organization or the United Nations Environmental Program. You know, typically such organizations help to shine a light on the problems described in the papers by offering support to local communities that may be disadvantaged by partnerships between corrupt or weak local governments and powerful countries like China. And for Dr. Meyerding, you sort of concluded without offering a thought for how things might move forward. And I wonder, is there some combination of external actors that you could envision outside the other claimants that might be able to shape or constrain Chinese behavior? And then finally, I think a question that the papers raised for me, and frankly, this might well be outside the scope of these papers, but the question did arise in my mind, is how you understand the relationship between China's domestic environmental policies and its environmental practices on the global stage. You know, I think one might reasonably expect that as China improves its own environmental policies at home, that its behavior on the global stage would similarly reflect that changing positive domestic dynamic. You know, I would point out that we have not seen that happen. I think in the case of, you know, China, for example, reining in its domestic coal consumption, it has not been mirrored in terms of its policies abroad, its export of coal-fired power plants through the Belt and Road Initiative. But I do wonder whether any of the speakers have explored this relationship in the context of Chinese domestic regulations around fishery resources or illegal logging, and whether you see the potential for those to be embraced in a positive way in China's global behavior. So I'll stop there. And thanks again for really a set of terrific papers.
Thank you, Liz. First, I would like to ask the speakers to briefly respond to the questions Liz raised in her comments. So Dr. Okora, why don't you go ahead if you feel that there's something in Liz's comments you need to respond to.
Thank you very much, Liz, for those excellent comments and overview. I'm very happy for the way in which you've characterized the papers and also the the role of role of China globally. Now, you asked a question about the role of the markets, and you're right. In actual fact, I did not mention in the paper, but the market and NGOs actually have a very strong influence in improving the way in which resources, particularly tuna resources, are being managed globally. So you've got this eco-labels, such as the Marine Stewardship Council, It's actually forced businesses to adjust the way in which they operate, so they ensure greater sustainability and also accountability. Then also, the retailers themselves are having a huge influence. So I think from my perspective, what I'm observing is that governments generally are a bit slow to respond to changes, but the industry themselves and also the market and retailers are not waiting. They're moving towards a lot of sustainability standards. They're also improving also on social accountability standards. On China, if I could just make one observation, I think as they grow their middle class, who will demand greater sustainability for seafood sourcing, you will see a change in the way in which the Chinese industry operates throughout the world, because their people will be demanding for greater accountability. And so that might be perhaps the game changer that we would be seeing. But it might come at a cost, at the cost to the resources, because between then and now, we don't know what will happen to the resources. But I'm convinced that the growing middle class, the younger people in China, will demand greater accountability from their fishing vessels. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Quora. Professor Maiding, anything you would like to say in response to Liz's comments?
Sure. First, thank you for the comments. I really appreciate it. Yes, I don't say anything that's particularly hopeful. Unfortunately, I'm not super hopeful about this situation. I've done some broader research on when countries cooperatively manage oil resources. And what I've found is, first, it's never been more than two rivals that cooperate, and second, they have to resolve their political problems first. So that's not promising. That being said, it is positive that I don't think these situations will escalate much. And I do have to say that if we're going to see more collaboration, and it pains me a little to say this, it will probably be the oil companies that are the sort of ones that rush in and actually make that happen. Because they actually have an incentive to develop the region's resources. They want peace, they want stability, they want security. And we have seen some cooperation among national oil companies in the past. That being the case, with oil prices so low, the incentives to engage in that kind of development of offshore resources in an area with deep water is low. So overall, unfortunately, the pessimism is the lack of a comment was kind of basically reflecting my pessimism on this issue being desecuritized and seeing collaboration in the future.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Maidi. Now, Professor Wang, would you like to say anything in response to Liz's comments?
Yes. Thank you very much, Professor Economy, for your comments and also those ideas you raised about the concerning with the fishery resources in the South China Sea. One thing I think you mentioned, it is a quite brilliant idea, that is about the post-state measures agreement. For I think that agreement has already been in power since the 2016, and for the practices for the past several years that we can see, there are still a weakness for that agreement. For example, one thing you mentioned about corruption, that is the possibly that will be the weak point for that agreement. And you also mentioned about is there any other any observation about the Chinese practice in the in this regard? I would like to say that I also worries about the Chinese fishing fleet because the power is getting stronger, and possibly just like Professor Akoro mentioned that seems Chinese government, they offer the subsidies and also to put their power into the Chinese fishing industry. Therefore, I think very possible that in the very near future that we can see another superpower for the fishing fleet in the world. Therefore, I think there might be some way to reduce or to confine the expanding speed for the Chinese fishing fleet. That will be to, for example, as I mentioned about the EU IUU regulation, so that for the fishing market, fishing products market, to pay attention to the expanding of the Chinese fishing fleets. I think that might be a good way to confine or to restrain the expanding speed for the Chinese. And I also agree with the Professor Quorum's comments about the European Union IUU regulation, because that so far that regulation is good for the management about the conservation and the management measures for the fishery resources. However, probably the wording that Professor Akoro mentioned, that is the proportionate, should be also pay attention to. Otherwise, that will be a very, not a very good measure for those economic developing countries or even the small island countries in the Indian Ocean or in the South Pacific Ocean. I think that is my very brief response to Professor Economy's comments and questions. Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Wang, Professor Wang, while I have you on the podium, there's a question from the audience. How has Taiwan's political status affected its participation in international fisheries management?
Okay, right. Thanks for this question. As we can understand that the Chinese international status is very unique. Everybody knows that Taiwan or the Republic of China is a country. However, it doesn't have so many formal international recognition from other countries. Therefore, for example, if we want to participate in the several fishing areas for the fishing activities, therefore we have to participate in the regional fisheries management organizations. And so far, I think there is a specific and a unique way for Taiwan to utilize that is the a specific term called the fishing entity. And that specific term was provided in the 1995 United Nations Fisheries Stocks Agreement. And also several other regional fisheries management organizations has applied this kind of a term, and also they give this kind of status to Taiwan. For example, one of the organization in the East Pacific Ocean, that is the Inter-American Tropical Tuna Commission, and also another organization in the Pacific Ocean, that is the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission. For those organizations, they have this kind of design specifically for Taiwan to participate. Therefore, I think that it would be a good way for Taiwan to participate in the International Fisheries Forum, and also to participate in those discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Wang. Any questions from the audience? You can use the Q&A button and send your questions to me. But while I'm waiting, I want to ask Professor Maiding this question. Do you think the strategy of denial has served China well? Or do you think there is a better strategy that would have served China even better?
So that's a great question. And I think I'll answer it to the best of my ability, not being a China foreign policy specialist. I think it's been surprisingly provocative. I think especially over the last couple of years, I was the amount of interference that Chinese ships have been doing to Malaysian and Vietnamese operations has surprised me some, and it's certainly not winning them any friends. So I feel like the costs to their reputation are higher than any benefits that they're going to be getting diplomatically. So I have a suspicion that there is more going on, or there are goals that I haven't yet identified. Because just looking at it, it doesn't seem like it's worth the costs of what they're doing. So my instinct is, so in terms of oil and gas interests, they're definitely not, this is probably not the way to go. In terms of other interests, maybe it is, but I need to do more research.
Well, thank you. Our last question goes to Ambassador Aquaro. This is from one of the attendees. You mentioned the influence of Malaysian logging companies. Can you comment on what the feeling is on recent PRC nationals settling in the Solomon Islands? Previously, they've been accused of taking over retail industries and et cetera. Have there been any tensions recently? And now that your government has recognized Beijing, how do Solomon Islands view the presence of PRC migrants? Thank you.
Okay. Now, thank you very much for that question. I'll start off by saying that we've had a long history of migrants from China. So, you know, we've got 4, 5, 6 generation Chinese who have settled in Solomon Islands and made Solomon Islands their home. It's the more recent migration patterns that we've seen tensions arise, because there's also probably a lack of sensitivity, as it were, to some of the cultures. And then also I'm just seeing that, you know, there's the introduction of a lot of the corrosive practices that they bring with them. And so it's undermining the quality of governance. And so I'm seeing If you come to Honiara, which is the capital of Solomon Islands, it's almost like a Chinatown. And I say so with a great amount of respect as well, from one end of the town to the other. And so there's a huge dominance of Chinese, particularly the newer Chinese. And so that's where the tensions have arisen. So we've had, in 2006, there was a burning of Chinatown. And then more recently last year as well, after the elections of the prime minister. And just recently in one of the provinces, when there was a special flight from China to Solomons, which brought in the Chinese ambassador, there was a closure of some of the shops on Malaita, particularly the Chinese shops. So yeah, there are these underlying tensions in which people see the dominance. But I take the view that they're providing jobs, but at the same time, there's a mutual benefit for everyone, that we can also learn from our Chinese businesses, from the people who come here. And then we can also impose conditions and standards on them. And so I think to that extent, you know, having the Chinese embassy and Chinese government here actually has that kind of institutional framework around which you can then deal with these people. Because I think prior to that, it was not possible to deal with them because they were not, you know, they were not nationals of Taiwan. So just speaking on the tensions underlying the switch from Taiwan to China, there's still some underlying tensions at the highest political level between Malaita, which is the largest and most populated province that we have, and then the national government. So they refuse to have anything to do with China, and openly refuse to accept any development assistance from China. And interestingly, for purposes of our discussion, the U.S. State Department, through the national government, have allocated a fairly significant for the country and for the province amount of money specifically for Malaita province, which I found quite interesting. So, you know, you've got all these tensions at being played now right at the national and provincial political level between the United States and China. So it makes for very interesting analysis and dynamics, I think. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Okpara. I have one last question for all the three panelists. Do you have a view about China's mining of rare earths and other minerals from the deep Pacific Ocean seabed and the absence of the U.S. from the UNCLOS that prevents it from competing in this race to mine the deep Pacific Ocean seabed? It's okay. Thank you.
So I can jump in on this one.
Please.
So I actually don't think that U.S. not being a signatory is going to restrict the United States from participating. That I believe that actually the desire to not have regulations on deep seabed mining was one of the reasons that the U.S. didn't sign UNCLOS to begin with. So I think that if American firms and actors want to participate, they will. I would just be surprised if they wanted to, because I think it's not very economic at this point to be engaging in deep seabed mining. So my suspicion is, though, that China, where they can encourage state-owned enterprises to participate, may get there first because the state is willing to subsidize it just for the purpose of getting there first. So I think the U.S. could lose the race, but not because of the UN Convention.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Wang, any thoughts on this issue?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have any ideas about this issue. But however, I think from the geographical setting, China actually is a kind of landlocked state. because the eastern side of the ocean line has been blocked by Japan, Taiwan, and the Philippines. Therefore, China is trying its efforts to expand its power into the western side of the Pacific Ocean through several discussions in the United Nations. For example, the BBNJ, biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction. I think that will be an issue that we have to pay attention to. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Quora, any thoughts on this rather sort of technical issue?
No, I don't have any additional comments to make on that, but I think generally speaking, the global community recognizes that some of these rules have morphed into customary international law, and therefore, you know, there's a certain minimum behavior, a standard of behavior that they observe. So that would be my sense of the issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's all the time we have. Please join me in thanking the three speakers and Lazy Economy. Thank you very much for this just wonderful session. Okay, Glenn, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Minxin. As manager of the project on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. We hope that you'll be able to join the four remaining sessions in this conference, which will meet every Monday and Thursday, or if you're in Asia and Oceania, Tuesday and Friday, at the same time for two more weeks. Our next session, entitled Economic Interdependence, Dangers and Opportunities Ahead, will examine how geostrategic competition is driving economic policy in the Indo-Pacific region. We hope to see you in 4 days. Thank you.